Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel teaches Messianic Judaism for all nations, and we would like to be your long-distance congregation. If you listen regularly at BethEmmanuel.org, consider supporting us with regular financial gifts and become a virtual member. Click on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org to learn more.
John chapter 11, and it's a lengthy story, so we're just going to kind of press through it. It's the story of the resurrection of Lazarus. It's the sixth out of the seven signs. That's about the seven signs of Messiah. So I guess they... John chapter 11, Yochanan chapter 11, in the Deutsch Hebrew English, we find it beginning on page 377. It says, and here's my plan for tonight, is just to read through the story, just so you know where we're going with this. Actually, to read through this chapter and to add comment along the way, okay? This is a very simple program tonight. There was a sick man, Lazar, from Beit Hinni, the village of Miriam and her sister Martha. So I want to, first of all, just stop with that and make sure we understand each of these. Beit Hinni is Bethany, right? Okay, so this is Bethany on the Mount of Olives. It's on the southeastern slopes of the southwestern slopes of the Mount of Olives. And today it's a village, the name of the village has been changed to Al-Azariah, which is Arabic for the village of Lazarus. All right? Because who's the most famous guy from this village? Anyway, we've been here before in the Gospels. There's the story of when the master stays here. He does some teaching in the home of these three siblings. It's interesting that you have three adult siblings living together, no parents. So my assumption is that they inherited this house from their parents. They're wealthy. They're obviously well-to-do. And it's Miriam, Martha, her older sister. And remember, Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needful. Miriam has chosen the good portion for herself, right? And Miriam is sitting at the feet of the master, learning while Martha is working in the kitchen, a text that has upset many women for many years. And then there's their brother, their beloved brother, Lazar. His name is Lazar. So Lazar is short for Eleazar. Eleazar, like Rabbi Eleazar of the Talmud, Eleazar. And we add the Greek ending to the short version, Lazar. We add the Greek ending that to show that it's a guy, and it becomes Lazarus, right? Okay, so this is the situation. There's a sick man, Lazar, from Beit Hinni, in the village of Miriam and her sister Martha. This is the Miriam that applied perfume to the master and wiped his feet dry with her hair, although that hasn't happened yet. But it's going to happen later in the Gospel of John. Lazar, her brother, was sick. His sisters sent for him, saying, "My master, look, the one you love is sick." It's interesting that Lazarus is called the one you love. This is actually just a term, I think, the way the Gospel of John uses the language to say, he's your friend, he's your beloved, you know, he's your close friend, your best friend, Lazarus. So it shows us that there's this relationship between this young man and the master that we didn't know about otherwise. Likewise, the author of the gospel, which we assume to be John, is also called the beloved disciple, right? And this has led some to speculate that Lazarus is the author of the gospel of John because he's the beloved disciple and he's called the one you love. Right. That's not consistent with the tradition that it's John the son of Zebedee is the gospel writer. But anyway, I just thought you might be interested in that particular idea that's out there in the world of endless academic speculation. His sister sent for him and said, "Master, the one you love is sick." Yeshua heard this and said, "This illness is not for death. Rather, it is for the glory of God, so the Son of God may be glorified in it." In other words, we don't need to worry too much about this. This is a strange, strange answer. Yeshua loved Martha and her sister and Lazar. So all three of the siblings. He has a very close relationship with all three of these siblings. I don't know of anyone else outside of his school of disciples that you could ascribe this close relationship. So there's something very special about these three siblings. You know, there have been ossuaries found with their names. Yeah, from this very region. Which isn't saying too much since the names are exceedingly common, except for Marta. Marta's not that common. Marta isn't even really a proper name. That Marta is like ma'am. That's like, Mar as Lord. Marta is like the feminine in the Aramaic. Well, Miriam is extremely common, and Eleazar certainly isn't uncommon. When he heard that he was sick, he delayed and remained for 2 days in the place where he was. And that's not what we expected. That's not what we anticipated. After he said to his disciples, "Come, let us return to the land of Yehuda." And now we find out why. Why is he delaying? Because it's dangerous for him to go back so close to Jerusalem. Right now, he's under an operation, since he was last there at the Festival of Sukkot, and that had almost ended badly when they picked up stones to stone him and so forth. And these sorts of situations, right? Or was it Hanukkah that he was there last? I can't remember. But in any case, I'm sure it ended badly. And he's now in a situation where he's trying to stay alive at least until the appointed time of Pesach. And so it's advisable not to go back to Jerusalem, back to Judea at this time. So his disciples warned him, and they said, "Rabbi, just now the Yehudim were seeking to stone you. Would you go back there?" And Yeshua answered, "Aren't there 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks by day, he will not stumble because he sees the light of this world. The one who walks in the night will stumble because the light is not with him." That's not really a good answer. It's a very cryptic answer. But what he is saying with this answer, he's hinting, we're not there yet. We haven't come to that hour yet. So maybe I don't need to worry about it just yet. There's an appointed time when it's going to be dark. Remember when it says that Judas left the table? He said, "Go do what you're going to do." And it says Judas got up and he left the table and it was dark. Yeah. Anyway, so we're not there yet. After he spoke things like this, he said to them, "Our beloved Lazar is asleep. I am going so that I may wake him." His disciples, who are still trying to dissuade him from making this dangerous trip, said, "My master, if he's sleeping, he will recover. You said this isn't going to end in death. You're the one who said this isn't going to end in death. Now you're saying he's asleep. All right, yeah, he's asleep. So that's not such a big thing. Maybe he's fallen into a swoon. It's not worth the trip." Yeshua was speaking about his death. But they thought he was speaking about sleeping for rest. Now, sleep is a metaphor. It's being used as a metaphor, like those who are asleep in the dust, right? But based on what he said, that this will not end in death, they're justified in taking him literally versus metaphorically. Yeshua said to them plainly, "Lazar is dead." It must have been a shock after he said this won't end in death. All right, but it won't end in death, as we know. Death is not the end. And that's one of the messages of this entire story, that death is not the end. And he says, "I'm glad for your sake I was not there so that you may believe. Now let us travel and go to him." Thomas, who is called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us go as well so that we may die with him." All right, so first of all, he says, "I'm glad for your sake." So he's confident. He's been praying about this already. He's obviously received direct word that he can be confident of what's going to happen. He's confident already in the outcome. Otherwise, this wouldn't have been an advisable thing to say. "I was glad that I wasn't there for your sake," and so forth. Right? So he already knows how this episode is going to end. Thomas, I used to read his words as fatalistic or cynical. "Well, we might as well go with him and die with him then," you know. But instead, I think I realized he's been teaching them, if anyone does not pick up his cross and follow me, he is not worthy of me, and so forth. And I think Thomas has internalized this. And he's like, all right, the rabbi's going, we're going. The rabbi might be killed, we might be killed. That's just the way it is. We're going to follow him. Loyalty, right? All right, so they make the trip. And they're making the trip. You know where they were when all of this, these conversations and so forth happened? They're down by Jericho, where John had been immersing. Actually, across the river, they had been, because they were laying low. They're trying to keep a low profile at this point. No longer working in the Galilee. No longer working openly at all. Trying to stay incognito. All right, so they make the trip. It's not a long trip. From there, it's a day. You know, it's a day's walk, I guess. Yeshua came and found him, who had been lying in the tomb for the last 4 days. Beit Hini is near Jerusalem, about 15 ris away. So we know this from the book of Acts as well, that it's close by. It tells us that it's a Sabbath day's journey. Well, it's a Sabbath day's journey to the point on the Mount of Olives where the road turns off toward Bethany is more like it. But it says, many of the Yehudim came to the home of Martha and Miriam to console them regarding their brother. So what do you see here? This is the custom of Shiva. He's been buried since the first day, since we bury immediately, right? Especially in the Middle East like this. The burial takes place. They would have washed the body. They would have wrapped the body. And the burial would have taken place immediately. And immediately after the burial, the Shiva begins. That's when the 7 days begin. So Shiva just means sitting. So they're going to come and they're going to sit with the survivors, with Martha and Miriam to console them. So they're coming. It says many of the Yehudim came. So this is the Judeans. Many of the Judeans, the people of Judea from Jerusalem and so forth, are coming to sit Shiva with them. When Martha heard that Yeshua had come, so she's there sitting with her guests, she gets up and she went out to greet him. But Miriam remained sitting in the house. She's staying with the Shiva. Martha said to Yeshua, my master, if only you had been there, for then my brother would not have died. We could have all said this many times. And, you know, every time we're bereaved, these words seem apropos. If only you had been there. If only you had been there, then my brother would not have died. And she says, even now I know whatever you ask of God, God will give you. And so this is like a sort of hint. She's hinting towards the miracle, the potential of a miracle even now. Yeshua says to her, your brother will surely rise. And Martha rejoins this. She said to him, I know he will rise on the rising at the last day. In other words, that's our religion already teaches that. Everybody knows there's going to be a coming resurrection on the last day. That's not what I was hinting towards, right? And Yeshua said to her, I am the rising. I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though he dies. Anyone living who believes in me will never die. Do you believe this word? All right, so this is kind of a contradiction. If you believe in Yeshua, you will live even if you die. And anyone living who believes in him will never die. Do you see how these two statements seem to contradict each other in a sort of riddle, like a Dr. Seuss-style riddle that needs to be figured out? But the sense of it is, the one who believes in the Messiah will live in the resurrection, even though he dies. He dies in faith in the Messiah. He will live in the resurrection. And anyone living who believes in me, so this is anyone living, anyone who is a person of faith, who has this quickening of spirit through, as he called it, to be born again, born not just of the flesh, but born of the spirit. Anyone who is living, who believes in me, will never die, even though he die. Will never die, meaning that death, the death of a disciple, is insubstantial. It's so insubstantial as to be regarded as not even being properly dead, because it's a transition from life to life to life. She said to him, "Yes, my master, I have believed that you are the Mashiach." And where's the rest? So what? How's that have to do with what he just said? Well, this is the point, that we have this expectation that the Messiah is going to come and he is going to bring the final redemption. And as a component of the final redemption, he is going to resurrect the dead. That is the eschatological expectation of Messiah. That's part of the 13 principles of Jewish belief to this very day. That principle number 12 is the coming of the Messiah. Principle number 13 is the resurrection of the dead, right? So, I mean, that's like the culmination, the last two things in the religion. And so if by saying, "I believe you are the Messiah, the Son of God who has come into the world," she's also affirming that she believes that he is the agent. He will be, in the future, the agent of the resurrection of the dead. And the implication is, if you can do it in the future, you can do it now. Having said this, she went and called for her sister Miriam privately, saying, "Look, the teacher is here, and he's calling for you." Now, there's this relationship between Miriam, the sister of Martha, and the master, which is left mostly unspoken and just hinted at in the text of the Gospels. And the relationship is this. It's like many people speculate that Mary Magdalene and the master had some secret romantic relationship. Probably not. My thinking is Mary Magdalene was old enough to be his mother. Yes. But this girl, Miriam, who pours out the perfume, the expensive perfume on him and so forth, and he tells his disciples, "Leave her alone," right? He reproaches them, right? "Leave her alone. She's done this. She's done a beautiful thing for me." It seems to me that if there was a romance in the gospel, it's between the master and Miriam, the sister of Martha. He's always defending her. He's like, she's chosen the good portion, right? And I'm thinking, you know, he knows this isn't going to be his lot. This isn't his fate. This isn't what has been assigned to him. He's not going to be able to take a wife. But if he was going to take a wife, if things had been different, if it might have been Miriam from Bethany. So it says, when she heard this, she arose and came to him. Yeshua had not yet entered the village. He was standing in the place where Martha had encountered him. And when the Yehudim who had come to her house, those who were sitting Shiva with her to console her, saw that Miriam had risen suddenly and gone out, they followed her. For they said, "She has gone out to the tomb to weep there," which is about the only thing that would seem appropriate for a mourner to do, to leave the house, would be to go out to weep at the tomb. And Miriam came to the place where Yeshua was standing, and she saw him and fell at his feet and said to him, "My master, if only you had been here," which is exactly what Martha had said, "for then my brother would not have died." And when Yeshua saw her weeping, and the Yehudim who had come with her weeping as well, his spirit became indignant and he trembled. All right, so when it says his spirit became indignant, that's a gentle way to translate this. Some of your Bibles would say he became angry, which is even more troubling than his spirit became indignant. And so I read, I was always bothered by this, like, angry? Really? Angry? What's he angry at? You know, these people who are, you know, these people who are mourners. And it says he saw her weeping. He saw the Jewish people with him, or the Judeans with her, also weeping over his beloved friend. He became angry. And so some of the explanations from Christian commentaries are amusing, such as, well, he became angry because of the hypocritical false weeping of the Jews. You know, these sorts of like just anti-Semitic type of, he became angry because they were Jews, basically, is the way that some of the commentaries take it. Other things are, he became angry because they were forcing him to do a miracle. It's just ridiculous answers. So, in reality, there's only two possible explanations. Well, we'll say three. I'll give you three possible explanations for why he became angry, okay? One, he's angry at death for robbing these people, for robbing him of his best friend. Not angry at the people, but angry at death for how it devastates the human heart. Okay? I could see that. That may be the case. Two, he's not angry, but as some versions of the Bible put it, he's deeply moved. And somehow something has been lost in translation, perhaps coming from a more Semitic version of this story as it moved into Greek. A translator misunderstood the pathos being expressed as anger versus being moved to passion, okay? Which can happen, you know, because words have like a different semantic sense from place to place and from use to use. And that can, when you're translating, it's very, very easy to grab the wrong one, you know? So that to me seems highly likely. But there's one more, and that's from the secret gospel of Mark. We might get a clue. I can't tell you about the secret gospel of Mark because then it wouldn't be a secret. But in the secret gospel of Mark, it says that he was angry with his disciples because, and this isn't in the text of John, but in the secret gospel of Mark, his disciples are rebuking Miriam and telling her to be quiet and not. And so he becomes angry with them. So that would be, once again, guess who's defending who, right? Which it becomes a pattern then. Okay, anyway. So he said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "My master, come and see." And then the shortest verse in the Bible. Right? Yeshua wept. Why did he weep? Well, I don't think it's a mystery. It's sad. But nevertheless, a lot of people make a mystery out of it. You know, why is he weeping? Well, it's isn't it clear? He loved Lazarus. He loves the sisters. It tears him up to see their sorrow. And he has genuine empathy. You know, sure, he knows he's going to do a miracle and he's prayed and God has told him, but that doesn't change. It's inappropriate not to weep at a funeral. It's inappropriate not to mourn with those who mourn, right? This is what Paul tells us. Rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. He tells us in Ecclesiastes, there's a time to rejoice and a time to mourn. This is the time to mourn. And the Yehudim said, how great is the love he had for him. But there were also some who said, is not the one who opens the eyes of the blind also able to prevent him from dying? Remember the last sign that we studied? When he opened the eyes of the blind man, and that actually was tried in front of the Sanhedrin. That whole case went in front of the Sanhedrin, and that's how it became one of the signs. One of the seven signs, because it was such a famous miracle, right? Once more, Yeshua grew indignant in his spirit. Same issue, angry. And came to the tomb, which was a cave with a stone over its entrance. Now, this tomb is still there in El Azaria. So we know something about the type of tomb. Unlike our master's tomb, which had a rolling stone in front of it, and you crouch down into this quite small opening. We're talking about a little opening, a door about maybe 3 feet high, you know, that you would crouch down to get into, and then you would step down into a narrow work pit that wasn't much wider than one of these plastic tables, and it would be surrounded by benches, three benches on which you could lay out a maximum of three bodies, and then there would be these shafts dug beyond the benches that you would, once you had prepared a body on one of these benches, you would lay them in the shaft where they could decompose. That was like the tomb of our master. That's a more standard tomb. Eleazar's tomb is pretty much the same, except rather than that rolling stone entrance, it instead you access the work chamber and the tomb complex by a vertical shaft. Okay, so you would. What you would find is we would step down into a garden where there's probably a couple different tombs that have been cut, and this, you know, sort of a garden area. And there's these stones marking the tombs would be large, flat stones on the ground like trap door covers, okay? And so that's the way Lazarus's tomb would be, right? And then underneath, you lift off one of those stones. And you understand the point of these tombs, it's actually very environmentally sound. These are reusable family tombs. And so you would go back in a year later after the bones had, after the body had decomposed, and you would gather the bones and put them in a small ossuary box, a stone box. And that box would be stored then in the tomb. And it was ready for reuse. And you could actually be processing as many as 9 bodies simultaneously. And a year later, you would go in. And I've always thought this is why we say Kaddish for a year. Because that's the time at which you would go in and gather the bones into the ossuary. And, or 11 months as it is. And so that's the situation, and this tomb has been closed. Lazarus is laid in the tomb. It's been closed now for 4 days. And it says, Yeshua said, "Remove the stone from it." Martha, the sister of the deceased, said, "My master, he has already begun to stink, for he has had 4 days." So you don't want to open this tomb. It's not just that nobody, you know, it's like it would smell badly, but that's actually dishonoring. To the dead, right? Okay. So Yeshua said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will behold the glory of God?" So he knows exactly what he's going to do here. It's complete confidence. He knows what he's going to do here. It's astonishing, isn't it? He's done this before. It's not his first resurrection. But the others are closer to resuscitations, don't you think? I mean, there was the boy of the widow at Nain who was being carried out. So he had died that same day because he was being carried out to be buried. He might have only been dead for a couple hours. Oh, or there was the daughter of the synagogue ruler, Yair, right, in Capernaum. Yep, and she was so freshly dead. She isn't dead. He tried that line on them and they laughed at him because they knew she was dead. But I mean, she had just died. He was on his way. He was on his way to her house when they said, "Oh, don't bother the teacher anymore. She's passed." Right? So those were closer to more like resuscitations, like we were talking about on Shabbats, near death experience type of situations. Not the case with Lazarus. Lazarus has been down for, this is the fourth day, right? This is the fourth day. There's actually, I was going to bring this up in one of the Shabbat teachings maybe this week. Maybe this Sabbath if we get to it. There's a saying in Genesis Rabbah. Bar Kapra says, "The very height of mourning is not until the third day." It's the first day, you're in shock. The second day, starting to sink in. Third day, that's boom, right? Okay. And his theory is, he explains why. He says, "For 3 days, the spirit wanders about the tomb, wondering if it may return to the body." So the spirit is kind of like, not sure what's happened here. But when it sees the faces become disfigured, so it started, it says, "Wait a second." You know, it realizes, you know, there's something wrong here. "Then it hovers no more, but leaves the body to itself." I think we'll have to talk about that. The point of this, from Genesis Rabbah is that that's the third day. On the fourth day, the spirit is definitely gone. Yeah. This person is dead, deceased. Okay, another one. This is from a different source, but it says, during the first 3 days, experts return to the cemetery and examine the dead to determine whether they are really dead. Because it happened that one of the dead was examined and found alive. And he lived 25 years after that. And to another one, that he begot five children after that, before he died. So sometimes, yeah, this goes in the category of don't you guys ever take a pulse, right? But that's the first 3 days. After 3 days, you don't need to keep checking. Okay. I don't know if that's really what they did, but apparently in one place they did. So they removed the stone where the deceased was placed. And so they removed the stone, and Yeshua lifted his eyes on high. And this is what he does when he prays. He lifts his eyes. Every time he's talking to Abba, he's talking to his father, he lifts his eyes up. It's kind of a thing of our master. Where it says that ordinarily, when you're praying, the correct posture is to lower your eyes like a servant before his master, right? The servant before his master, he doesn't look his master in the eyes, he lowers his eyes. But Yeshua, he lifts his eyes to the Father. Okay, so he lifts up his eyes, and he says, I thank you, my Father, for you have answered me. I know that you always answer me. However, on account of these people who are around me, I have spoken so that they will believe in me that you have sent me. It's a funny prayer. I have always kind of like, it's like, what? I thank you that you've answered me. I know you always answer me. I mean, it just sounds like a little bit of braggadocious. Yeah, braggadocious or something. You know? Isn't that a bit much? Braggadocious? Braggadocious. Yeah. But it's really not. Here's the point of the prayer, as I understand it. There are those who have come to see Yeshua as a miracle worker, rightly so, because he is. But then the danger with a miracle worker is that the miracle worker believes, or other people believe, that he works the miracles himself. That he is the source of the power and the miracles, right? And so what Yeshua is doing, he doesn't pray like this very often. We don't hear he doesn't ordinarily break into public prayer in front of a bunch of people. That's not his style. It's not really even a normal sort of Jewish mode of prayer, right? But in this case, he's making a very public prayer and a very public statement. He's about to do what's going to be a very public miracle. And how is he doing this? It's the Father who is doing this. He's prayed about it. God has answered him, and God is going to do the miracle through him. And the point is, for the sake of those around me, I've spoken so that they will believe in me that you have sent me. Okay, so that's one thing. A second thing about this prayer that makes it unusual and really unique in the ministry of the Master. Remember at the beginning of this class, I said, Yeshua doesn't do signs. He doesn't do things for the sake of demonstrations and so forth. He does things because he's moved with compassion. People ask him for a sign. He says, an evil, adulterous generation seeks a sign and so forth, right? So he doesn't do signs. But this time, this is an exception. According to this prayer, according to what he's saying, on account of these people who are around me, I've spoken so that they will believe in me that you have sent me. He knows that this is going to be a sign. That isn't to say that he's doing it specifically as a sign. He's doing it because he loves Lazarus and Mary and Martha. And they asked him to come. But he knows for sure, and maybe his little delay as well to come a couple days after the fact, he knows for sure that this is going to be taken as a major sign. And so these words of declaration, this is going to be taken as a sign. So I thank you that they will know that this is evidence that you, Father, have sent me. When he finished speaking, he called out in a loud voice, "Lazar, arise, come out." The deceased came out, his hands and feet wrapped in burial garments, his face covered with a headscarf. He's like a mummy. He comes out wearing So if you have ever seen how we bury someone, and you probably haven't because it's closed casket, right? But if somebody is buried in traditional Jewish burial garments, they're going to have a hard time moving because they are wrapped up tightly in these things. I mean, there's these things are knotted around and so forth. It's not like they can't move, but you're almost a mummy, okay? And so that's how I picture Lazar coming out, pretty much a mummy, and with the head cloth still over his face, you know, so you can't see where he's going or who's standing around there. He just comes climbing up, and you got to see that. Think of that. It's we've opened the trap door in the courtyard and calling down into the darkness, "Come out." And that's kind of freaky. And then this guy comes climbing up out of the ground, out of this hole in the ground, wrapped in this stuff. You can't even see his face. You know, it's got to be frightening. And Yeshua said to them, "Release him and let him go on his way." So when it says release him, that means like untie these garments from him, you know, so and let him go on his way, right? What they do, it says, when many of the Yehudim who had come to Miriam saw what Yeshua did, they believed in him. All right, I want to just make a contrast here for you. Because this sixth big sign of Messiah is obviously setting us up for sign number seven. Okay, it's preparing us for sign number seven, which is going to be the resurrection of Yeshua himself. All right. But there's a difference between the resurrection of Lazarus and the resurrection of Yeshua, even as told just in the Gospel of John. And the clue here that we shouldn't miss is these burial garments. That Lazarus comes out of the tomb wrapped in these burial garments. But regarding the resurrection of the Master, the burial garments are left behind in the tomb. And so this indicates to us that the resurrection of Lazarus is not the same thing as the resurrection of Yeshua. They're two different types of processes. So the resurrection of Lazarus, even though it's surely a miracle and certainly a sign and a miraculous thing, it's a resurrection back to mortality. And so he comes out of the tomb still bound in the garments of mortality, right? Just like the body is called the garment of the soul, he's still dressed in the garments of the flesh, so to speak, of mortal temporary life. Meaning Lazarus is fated to die again, right? Okay. When the Master comes out, he leaves behind those garments of uncleanness, indicating that he has taken on a new state that's not touched or tainted by death. And that is the immortal, resurrected flesh of the world to come. Wow. Okay? So I think that's a very important distinction that the Gospel of John wants us to make between these two resurrections, these two events. Obviously, as a sign, the significance of the Messiah's command over the dead, to be able to resurrect the dead. And I know I've mentioned other resurrections in the other gospel narratives, but there aren't in John. This is the first resurrection in the Gospel of John. So if we're just reading John and just reading John for the signs, this is the whoa moment. This isn't just turning water to wine anymore. We started with turning water to wine and said, oh, that's a sign of the Messianic era. Well, what else is a sign of the Messianic era other than an abundance of agriculture and an abundance of wine, miraculous fertility and so forth? Well, another sign of the Messianic era is the resurrection of the dead. Yes. And so if he has the power to raise the dead, it's just like Mary or Martha said earlier. She said, I know at the end of days, the dead will be raised. And she said, I believe you're the Messiah. I believe you have the power to do this. So this functions as a sign, not just on the level of, wow, that's amazing. How did he do that? But wow, that's amazing. That's something the Messiah will have to do. That's something the Messiah is going to be able to do in the Messianic era. All right, great. Now, the reaction. So, all these Judeans who had come to sit Shiva with Miriam and with Martha, they see this and it says, and they believed in him. So, boom, the instant batch of disciples right here. And there were some who went to the Parshim and told them what Yeshua had done. Why did they do that? Well, it's just like the case of we learned about last time in the case of the man who had been born blind. They went and told the Parshim, not because they're tattling, just like the case of the man healed at the pool of Bethesda who went and he told it wasn't because they're tattling and trying to get Yeshua in trouble. Rather, they're saying, wow, you guys, God did an amazing thing here. We had an epic scale miracle, right? And it's like, you got to see this. And they want to bring this to the attention of the religious authorities, the religious leadership here. This is a sign. This guy is the Messiah. And they want them to, they're hoping that they will see and endorse him as the Messiah. Right? All right. So then it says, then the leading priests, those are the Sadducees, and the Parshim, the Pharisees, assembled a Sanhedrin and said, what will we do? For this man does many signs. So far, we've learned 6 of them. If we do not restrain him, all of them will believe in him, and the Romayim, the Romans, will come and take both our land and our people. When it says they will come and take our land and our people, what they're referring to is, you understand the danger here. These people expect him to be the Messiah. They will certainly start to follow him. At some point, he's going to make the claim for himself. He's going to say, I'm king. He's going to lead an insurrection against Rome. Rome is going to react by sending in the legions. And we're going to be the ones with our backs up against the wall. We'll lose our political authority here. We'll lose our autonomy. And we will probably lose our, be going to exile, which, of course, all of that eventually happens, right? One of them, named Caiapha, the high priest that year, that's Caiaphas. By the way, we have definitely found Caiaphas's ossuary. We have his ossuary. It's in the Israel Museum. And it's an ornate, beautiful bone box. Have Caiaphas' bones. They were still in it. So one of them, named Caiapha, the high priest that year. Oh, and he's still dead, too, by the way. He said to them, you do not know anything. You do not even understand that the death of one man on behalf of the nation is better for us than the destruction of the entire people. So in other words, he's saying, we got to kill this guy before people start following him and declaring him to be the Messiah and he leads an insurrection. It'd be better to kill him now. Assassinate him is what he's really calling for. You know, get rid of him one way or another. Rub him out. Because even though that would be a sin, you know, it's a lesser of two evils, which is worse, you know.
Saves the nation.
Yeah, it's got to save the nation. We're doing this for the good, for the common good. We need to kill this guy. That's what he's saying. The disciples thought this was ironic. And we have this little commentary from the apostles. They say, he did not speak this word out of his own heart, out of his own mind, for he was the high priest that year and was prophesying that Yeshua would die on behalf of the people. So they saw in this statement must have been reported to them, probably by Nicodemus, who would have been present, or Joseph of Arimathea, who was present. You know, one of these disciples, the secret disciples on the Sanhedrin, would have been reported. You should have heard what he said, you know. And they said, well, that turned out to actually be true. And it was not on behalf of the nation alone, but also to gather the scattered sons of God that they may become one. All right, who are the scattered sons of God? Well, this I would take as a certain reference to not just on behalf of the nation of Judea alone that they were concerned about, but the whole diaspora. There are Jewish people scattered through the whole diaspora, and it's part of Messiah's job to gather them together, to gather in the Jewish people back to the kingdom. So I think I would take that as the original meaning. But John's congregation in Ephesus that's transmitting this gospel to us would certainly have seen themselves as part of those scattered children of God, right? Because they've become, you know, this other flock that's also going to be gathered, like we read in John 10, and there shall be, you know, one flock and one shepherd. And so they see themselves as part of this diaspora. They deliberated together to put him to death from that day on. So from that day on, from the day they heard about the resurrection of Lazarus, from that day on, they're planning to put Yeshua to death. In other words, by resurrecting Lazarus in such a public manner, Yeshua ensured his own death sentence. For this reason, Yeshua no longer walked among the Yehudim in the eyes of the people. So he didn't stay around Judea. Instead, he departed from there to the land near the wilderness, to the town of Ephraim, and he dwelled there with his disciples. All right, so Ephraim is not quite correct for the name of this village. Ephraim is sort of a reconstruction, but the actual name of the village is Ophrah. Ophrah. Ophrah is down towards, well, if I can't, without a map, I can't really show you where. It's not too far. It's a remote village. It's the village of Ophrah. We know it today as I think it's called Taibe, because when it became, the Arabic became the predominant language of the village. Ophrah and all other villages named Ophrah had their names changed to Taibe, because Ophrah means, in Arabic, means something like something negative, bad, cursed, demonic. And it doesn't sound good. It's not a nice name for a village. So they just flipped the name over to Taibe, which is good. Yeah, so, I mean, why is this so important that you know about this? Because there's a spring in Taibe, in Ophrah, that our master surely must have drank from. While he's there, he's staying there. He's hiding out in this village. He's there like for months before, you know, before the final Passover. And so there's this spring in this village. It's an artesian well that's renowned. And there's a Christian Arab presence that's been there forever and ever and ever. And they have a brewery. And they make beer. And it's called Taibe. You can buy it in Israel. I've never had this beer myself, but I've always wanted to, just as a thought, you know, of surely our master drank from the spring from which this beer was made. Just a thought. All right, so it says, he went to the town of Ephraim and dwelled there. And the days of the Pesach for the Yehudim drew near, and so now we get into Passover. So now we're going to go straight into the Passover narrative. So he's staying there, he's hiding out there after this notorious miracle. He's hiding out there until Passover, and then we move on with the story. if we were to move on into chapter 12, we find him back with the family in Bethany, back with Miriam and Martha and Lazar, right? And then down in verse 9, the local people find out he's there, and it says they came out to greet him in Bethany. It says they came not just on his account, but also to see Lazar, whom he had awakened from the dead. And the leading priest decided to kill Lazar as well, for many of the Yehudim had come there on his account and believed in Yeshua. Yeah, poor guy. Right. Thanks for nothing.
Thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's extended virtual family and support our efforts for the kingdom with a gift by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.